Hello everyone, my name is Reese Karlinski and this is Young History, episode 166 on South Korea. The capital of this country is Seoul, and Korea got its name because of the word Joseon. Joseon was the name of the country in ancient and modern history as two separate entities. The original Joseon Kingdom is now referred to as Old Joseon or Gojoseon. Joseon means pristine mourning for its youth and hope for success in the early days of its foundation. The more recent Joseon state used a name to establish legitimacy by taking the old powerful title. And then it was just the influence of the West and Korean shaping more as a language that saw the word Korea be pulled from Joseon. Because even outside of this, there was also the state of Goryeo, which all had the same kind of language breakdown, and Goryeo, Korea, kind of sound similar. So that's how we pulled that name as well. And now some facts. South Korea boasts the fastest average internet connection speed in the world, with internet speeds averaging around 139 megabits per second, compared to the global average of 92 megabytes per second. Karaoke, known as Norebang in Korea, is a popular pastime across the country. There are countless Norebang establishments across the country where people can rent private rooms and sing their hearts out with anyone they please. South Korea also has the highest rate of plastic surgery in the world, and this is heavily connected to the K-pop culture and the beauty standards over there, which are heavily focused on women being very, very skinny, their skin being very porcelain and pale, and there's different surgeries you can do to enhance this and make it more easy compared to different beauty standards that are present in different parts of the West. South Korea is also a paradise for food lovers, with a vibrant street food scene and countless restaurants open 24 hours a day. And then Seoul's subway system is one of the busiest in the world. It transports millions of passengers each day, and it is known for its efficiency, cleanliness, and extensive network of lines that are connected by the city's neighborhoods and attractions. Despite the effectiveness of this new technology, Seoul still uses subway officers to corral large crowds and maintain safety in emergency situations. These officers have been noted many times for how important they are, because sometimes a train door will malfunction, sometimes things will be moving too fast, a person will fall, and it's these officers that use human emotion and human intellect to actually go in and stop something bad from happening, where a machine is just kind of made to be most efficient. So it's a very cool part of the system. But with that being said, that's pretty much all I have for you guys to start, and I don't want to dilly-dally any more than I usually do, because we've got a lot of history to go through here. It's a very, very cool history. I've found North Korea very fascinating when I did it, and I also found the same with South Korea. So the Korean Peninsula is just very, very cool. Despite all the ups and downs it's had, it's an awesome country. So nonetheless, we've got a lot of culture to talk about, a lot of history, a lot of ups, a lot of downs, and we're gonna get right into it. So I'm very glad you guys are here. I'm very glad you guys want to watch this one, and thank you for sticking with me for so many episodes. So let's do this thing. My name is Reese Karlinski, this is Young History, and this is South Korea. People first arrived on the Korean Peninsula in a time unknown, but our first major notable influence is the spread of the rice paddy field culture that came from the fertile region of China around 1500 BC. Gojoseon was the first major kingdom to rise in Korea. Legends state that it began in 2332 BC, but a more recent date is much more likely. In the Bronze Age, around 850, the kingdom was already around. It was around this point that Chinese writers mentioned this Korean kingdom. Gojoseon was eventually invaded by Wu of Han China in 108. Gojoseon was eventually invaded by Emperor Wu of Han China in 108. This broke it down into many smaller states. In the Iron Age, the southern part of Korea was formed into a society called Jin. The Jin state was made up of different city-states and towns that joined a loose confederation. The Jin state left daggers and pots for us to find today. Han Dynasty China invaded the northern parts of the peninsula in the 100s BC. The Samhan confederations formed in the south. It was led by Mahan, which was a confederation of 40-plus states. Alongside it were the states of Bianohan and Jinhan, which were about 12 states each that united into larger confederations. By the end of the 200s CE, the kingdoms of Baekje and Shilla were formed when they consolidated power over the confederacy. Bianhan consolidated into a six-state confederation called Gaya. Ye was a region inhabited by Koreans living in the central part of the peninsula. It formed into a vassal state of the Goguryeo, which was that larger state in the north. And while all of this happened, Goguryeo expanded its power across the northern peninsula and a lot of China. And now that the powers had become official kingdoms, the kingdom of the Baekje, Shilla, and Goguryeo, the Three Kingdoms period began. The focus was on these big three because Gaia and the other states present weren't actual kingdoms, so we kind of just acknowledge this as the Three Kingdoms period because of the influence they bring across the region. And it was stated in late Chinese scripture that all the Three Kingdoms spoke the same language and shared a culture. But Chinese scholars also claim that the kingdoms used Taoist script and had Confucian-based beliefs, which meant a lot of their culture was derived from old Chinese culture. Goguryeo was attacked by Xianbei, which were the people who were the ancestors of the Mongolians. While this happened, the Baekje finished off the Mahan states in the south and consolidated power across the entire southwest. The Baekje then invaded Pyongyang, which was a major city in Goguryeo and is today the capital of North Korea. The large city was nearly destroyed, and the king of Goguryeo was killed. Goguryeo actually turned north to conquer the regions of Buyeo in China. Shilo and Goguryeo entered an alliance in order to challenge Baekje. With this alliance, the powers invaded the vassal of Ye, which was the most densely populated part of the peninsula. Heavy pressure was now laid at the feet of the Baekje. Gwangeto rose at the same time. He was a great military leader of Goguryeo, who ruled with military prowess from 391 to 413. He invaded Baekje, conquered the capital, and then moved on to Shilo. As he moved on Shilo, the Japanese states of Wa and the Baekje attempted to combine with the Shilo against the forces of Gwangeto. All of them were defeated. Goguryeo marched on Shilo and made it into a subsidiary of Goguryeo. The later Yan dynasty invaded the northern parts of Goguryeo, but still had to face Gwangeto after he returned from the south. The Yan were defeated, and Gwangeto moved to take some of their land for his troubles. He had to defend against yet another large invasion from the Japanese Wa kingdom. Once they were defeated, Gwangeto moved north and expanded the territory even more. Gwangeto eventually retired to become a political figure, similar to the role of Emperor of China. He left his son Jiangsu to rule after his death. Jiangsu took power in 413 and had a long reign until 491 CE. He remained in power all the way until he was 98 years old. And this made him, even to this day, the longest reigning monarch in East Asian history because it was a 78-year reign. In this time, the Baekje became well known for its skilled sailors and its gold craftsmanship. And Shilo, which was the poorest of the three kingdoms, ended up rising to power once it was able to use diplomacy for royal marriages. The economy would be improved rapidly, and this caused large investments in the military. Shilo made an alliance with Baekje in hopes to challenge Goguryeo. The alliance wasn't strong enough, and both were defeated. They lost land to Goguryeo and had their stable kingdoms disrupted. And the peak of the Goguryeo kingdom was in the 400s. Goguryeo started to fall into some internal conflict because of how rich the nation had become. Once Jiangsu passed away in 491, there was a lot of divide over who should rule the kingdom next. This allowed both Shilo and Baekje to expand their influence in the south as internal issues tore up the north. At this point, the states of Gaia were still around, but Shilo and Baekje worked against them. In 532, the capital of Gaia fell to Shilo, and by 570, the entire region was under the rule of Shilo. Shilo had grown to be the second strongest kingdom on the peninsula after heavy investments in its military. Shilo was gunning for first place, so they betrayed Baekje and invaded in 660. Baekje was defeated, but the king mounted a revolt with 30,000 men to challenge Shilo. Goguryeo saw the growth in South Korea and was able to put aside its internal divisions in order to be strong in the face of Shilo, which was very likely to invade. Sui Dynasty China, at the same time, invaded Goguryeo and lost 300,000 troops when the Goguryeo army flooded them with a dam to end the war. A 300-mile wall was made to block off China. Then, the Tang Dynasty rose in China to replace the Sui. The Tang invaded. They marched on Goguryeo and failed, but this wasn't the end. After the invasion of the Baekje by Shilo, an alliance between Baekje and Goguryeo was formed. In reaction to this, Shilo made an alliance with Tang Dynasty China, who had just lost to Goguryeo. Baekje was then invaded by not only Shilo, but 120,000 Tang China troops. The kingdom was folded into Shilo, and the last king was taken prisoner by the Tang. Then, many campaigns were launched against Goguryeo. In 668, Pyongyang was invaded and conquered in the north. The Tang defeated Goguryeo as well. Shilo then united the entire peninsula. This period is known as Unified Shilo, which lasted from 668 to 935. Not long after this, though, Emperor Gaozong of Tang China launched an invasion against Shilo in 670, and a war would be fought for 6 years. After a lot of fighting, the Shilo were able to create a stronghold in the southwestern part of the peninsula. From this stronghold, they spread their influence across most of Korea while battling the Tang invaders. The war ended in 676 after Tang China gained a lot of the land in the northern part of the peninsula, but they were not able to finish off the Shilo. The rule of Shilo was reestablished and would last for over 2 centuries. Sheila rule brought a lot of different changes. Culture was homogenized and a lot of cultural art would be produced. However, there was a very strict caste system that was put in place across the peninsula. It was called the bone rank system. The system placed those that had royal bone lineage as the only ones able to actually rule the nation. There were ranks below the king, and they were decided by status within the society. Many people were demoted from one rank to another, but it was almost impossible to actually ascend the ranks. This means that class mobility didn't exist in Sheila. However, Sheila began to decline in the 800s, due mainly to a lack of economic growth and loss of military dominance. Two kingdoms formed to challenge the rule of Sheila, and they later took the names Goguryeo and Baekje. They did this to establish legitimacy and use those names to have ancestral claim to land. And this began the later Three Kingdoms period. This lasted from 889 to 936. In the north, King Taijo founded Goryeo as a new and powerful kingdom. This came after he ended the rise to power of Gongnyeong, who was a Buddhist extremist. Goryeo would go on to conquer and unite the entire peninsula in 918. The unity was made official once King Taijo married 29 prominent royal women across all of Korea. It is from this Goryeo kingdom that Korea derived its name. Just listen to it. Goryeo, Korea. It's very similar. Goryeo's rule lasted until 1392, and Goryeo got into a war with Liao Dynasty China. The war was very back and forth, but Goryeo was able to establish itself as the prominent power in Korea, but it did have to give up land concessions to not have to continuously give things up to Liao Dynasty China. But there would be something that hit Korea much harder. The Mongol invasions began in 1231, and they started years of conflict that tore Goryeo to shreds. The Korean population didn't lay down and take the invasion. The peasantry and other populous parts of society formed into the righteous armies to defend Korea. This is the basis of Korean resistance culture, which continues to define the history of this nation even to this day. Once the invasion was concluded, Goryeo was left to be a tributary state of the Yuan dynasty. Scholars across Goryeo accepted the status in order to avoid challenging the Yuan even further. However, around the same time, General Yi Xiongyi successfully repulsed the Red Turban invaders, and this gave him great prowess as a military leader. The critical turning point came in 1388, when Yi Xiongyi was ordered to lead a campaign against the Ming dynasty in China, which had replaced the Mongol Yuan dynasty. Realizing the campaign would be disastrous, Yi Xiongyi decided to turn his army back to the capital, Kaesong, and stage a coup against the Goryeo king. After seizing power, Yi Xiongyi declared the founding of a new dynasty in 1392, which he named Joseon. This signaled the beginning of a fresh start or morning freshness. He moved the capital from Kaesong to Hanyang, which is modern-day Seoul, and he established a new political and administrative system. And this would be the start of 500 years of consistent Joseon dominance. General Yi Xiongyi is marked as one of the most influential military figures in the history of Korea because he is the one that shifts it away from kind of a Mongol tributary state to being one that is stoutly independent. And things become official with Taijo of Joseon. He formed the Joseon Kingdom and its dynasty in 1392 after his generals completely overthrew Goryeo. Joseon went on to kill all members of Goryeo's royal family so that it would be unimposed. And after the capital was moved to Seoul, Taijo also fixed relations with China and Japan. A social class system was then created under Joseon. Yangban was made up of high-ranking civil workers and military members as well as aristocrats. Then there was the Yongjin, which was made up of well-educated professionals and ministers. Sangmin was the largest group of commoners, working-class citizens, and peasants. And below that was the Cheonmin, which were workers who did uncivil labor, quote-unquote. But even below that was the Nobi, who were forcefully enslaved people who were sent to do hard labor across Joseon. Many of these people being of African descent. Sejong the Great ruled from 1418 to 1450. He is very aptly known as the Great. He was behind the creation and use of the Korean alphabet, and he set the example of scientific education being a virtue. This started with the Hangui script, which is widely considered one of the most descriptive language scripts in the world. This is because it was shaped around the sounds that humans make, not the tone we use, and therefore it could theoretically be used as the basis for any speech communication. And recently there has been a big movement to actually have Hangui be the basis for global communications, since it would be understood by everyone if used correctly. And all of this caused a shift in Joseon culture, which made it to be much more educated and focused on encouraging growth. Things would not continue to go very great for Korea, because in 1592, the Imjin War began when Japan invaded. The siege of Busanjin in May of 1592 was particularly brutal to the Korean population. At the Battle of Hangui in 1593, the Koreans resisted and defeated an invasion from a Japanese force that outnumbered it 10 to 1. 30,000 invading Japanese soldiers were defeated by less than 3,000 Korean ones. China began to side with Joseon against the Japanese forces. The war left behind a million dead Joseon citizens, either directly from the fighting or other destructions and diseases that went rampant as Korea was invaded. Yi Sun-sin was the most prolific and successful Korean military leader throughout this period. His genius shined at the 1597 naval battle of Myeongnyang. With only 13 ships, he defeated an entire Japanese naval fleet that was at least 10 times larger. What makes it even more impressive is that he did this without losing a single ship in the battle. This is one of the most decisive battles and led to the end of the Imjin War. The Manchus of the Manchuria region of China actually marched into Joseon not long after and wanted to take advantage of recovering Joseon. This occurred in 1627. They invaded because of the alliance between Joseon and the Ming Dynasty China. Joseon was defeated and was forced to accept surrender terms with the Manchus. The constant wars and fighting that had occurred across the Korean Peninsula led Joseon to becoming much more isolationist. Isolationism was led by Joseon, which pulled the entire peninsula into a period of pulling out of the global scene. It was done in hope to isolate itself from attacks and negative influence, but all of this actually gained Joseon the moniker of the Hermit Kingdom. Isolationism contributed to the cultural and intellectual stagnation in Korea, because it limited exposure to new ideas, innovations, and advancements from other parts of the world. While Confucianism flourished during the Joseon Dynasty, other intellectual and cultural developments were constrained by the hard isolationism. Kim Yuk was a state chancellor that preached and wrote about laws around how to conduct politics. His policies focused on common sense, respect, and adjustment within isolationism, and Joseon faced a period of relative peace and overall stability. As the 1800s rolled in, it became clear that the Korean Peninsula might be forced out of isolation because despite it getting very in touch with its old culture, the rest of the world didn't really like that it was isolationist. One of the major events was the rebellion of Hongryong-rae, which occurred in 1812. It was a rebellion started because of the high taxes and low wages, which made most of the working class unable to afford a good quality of life. On top of this, the Western world was heavily pushing for Korea to open itself up to the global market. Western powers actually made a move against Korea on two separate occasions to try and pull it into the global sphere. France invaded in 1866. The French forces targeted Gangwa Island, which guarded the approach to the Han River, and led to the Korean capital. During the incursion, the French forces looted and desecrated several royal Joseon tombs on Gangwa Island. These actions caused outrage across Korea. After several skirmishes and facing logistical challenges, the French expedition withdrew. The campaign lasted only a few weeks and failed to achieve any significant diplomatic concessions or changes in Korea's foreign policy. Then the U.S. tried their hand with an invasion in 1871. This occurred after initial diplomatic efforts failed, but American forces attacked and tried again to capture the same place, Gangwa Island. The conflict led to the loss of over 300 Korean soldiers and 3 Americans. Despite the military victory, the Americans were unable to secure a treaty or audience with Korean officials, and this made sure that Korea would not be forced out of isolationism, at least by the U.S. So realizing how futile their efforts were, the U.S. withdrew their expedition. Just a little bit east, there was the Meiji Restoration, which saw Japan accept Western ideals and technology into the traditional society of the nation. This meant that Japan modernized its military while still holding on to some of its imperial values. These beliefs and newfound military advancements allowed Japan to pressure Korea into opening up its trade. The large military of Japan moved on Korea and made it clear that there would either be a destructive war or a concession made. The concession was conferred with the Japan-Korea Treaty of 1876, which pretty much brought Korea under Japanese control and forced it back into the global market. Right around this time, the Donghak movement emerged in the 1860s as a grassroots socio-religious movement led by Kuo Ji-yu, who was a Korean scholar and farmer. Donghak, which means Eastern learning, sought to address the social and economic injustices faced by Korean peasants and to promote principles based on Confucianism, Buddhism, and Taoism. All these things seem to have been lost with the adoption of Japanese culture and being forced under the Japanese yoke. In this period, peasants in Korea faced numerous grievances, including heavy taxation, oppressive feudal practices, and land disputes. There was also corruption among local officials, exploitation by landlords, and dominance of the aristocracy. The Donghak movement provided a platform for peasants to voice their grievances in secret forms. The movement gained momentum throughout the 1870s and 1880s. It attracted followers from across Korea, particularly in rural areas. The hope of the movement was to emphasize social equality, moral purity, and resistance against foreign influences, including Japan's encroachment. The repression of the Donghak movement sparked a full-scale rebellion in 1894, as thousands of Donghak followers, followed by disaffected peasants and disenfranchised members of the military, rose up against the government. The rebellion quickly spread across the Korean countryside and posed a serious challenge to the authority of Joseon. The rebellion coincided with the First Sino-Japanese War, which was fought from 1894 to 1895, during which China and Japan vied for influence over Korea. Both China and Japan had heavy influence in the conflict, with Japanese forces ultimately siding with the Korean government to suppress the rebellion. The Donghak Rebellion was brutally suppressed by the government and Japanese forces, resulting in significant loss of life and destruction. Choju, who was the leader of the movement, was captured and executed. On March 29, 1897, Joseon declared itself the Korean Empire. The declaration symbolized Korea's deep desire to modernize and assert sovereignty in the face of a lot of invasion. The main reason this was done was to modernize and strengthen Korea amidst a lot of external pressures. Korea was facing a lot of encroachment by Japan, China, Russia, and it led to a huge sense of urgency in not only establishing tight sovereignty, but also modernizing, which would happen much faster in the empiric system. But speaking of Russia, the Russo-Japanese War was fought from 1904 to 1905. Part of the reason for it was to control parts of Korea. Battles occurred in these years at the nearby Liaodong Peninsula. However, Japan established itself as the premier power in Asia-Pacific when it gained an upset victory over Russia. A big reason this actually happened was because of the fact that relations between Russia and Britain were not good. So when Russia wanted to use the Strait of Gibraltar to move their navy across the Mediterranean and then down through the Suez Canal, this request was actually denied because the Baltic Fleet was the most powerful fleet of the Russian navy, and they had to, instead of sailing it just through Gibraltar and then across the Mediterranean, down the Suez Canal into Japan, they actually had to go all the way down to Gibraltar, then all the way around Africa, and take that trip from Cape Coast all the way to Japan. And because of this, there was so much time between the arrival of the navy and when the war started that Japan actually got the upper hand and was able to establish victory by the time the navy got there. In 1910, the Empire of Japan invaded Korea and encapsulated it into the large Pacific Empire, and this was confirmed with the Japan-Korea Annexation Treaty. And the reason Japan was able to do this was because now that it beat Russia, nobody was challenging it in the region. And Japanese rule was truly horrible across Korea. Discrimination, cultural suppression, abuse, and more were thrust upon the Korean population. Japan hoped that by suppressing Korea, they would be able to access all the resources and trade power of that peninsula. Then there was the March 1st movement. It happened in 1919. The movement was a large protest against forced assimilation into Japanese culture and the suppression of Korea as a whole. Japan heavily suppressed this protest, killed hundreds, and committed other horrible acts of inhumanity. Following this was the Jamri Massacre, which occurred on April 15, 1919. Villagers of Jamri were burned alive in a church for being affiliated with a resistance protest. Japanese rule continued to suppress Korean culture and try to push Japanese superiority. Japan never apologized for this and never even acknowledged it, and then continued to force more things on the Koreans. Japanese was spoken in Korean schools and taught across the peninsula. The same children were told to bow before the flag of Japan whenever they saw it as a way to get rid of their national pride. In World War II, things got even worse. Soshikaime was a policy that tried to force Koreans into taking Japanese names as a final nail in the coffin of Korean culture. Millions of Korean men were forced to serve the Imperial Japanese Army, either as soldiers or labor workers to keep feeding the Japanese war machine. However, the worst Korean suffering happened to the women. Pleasure women or comfort women was a term given to Korean mothers, daughters, and wives that were forced to sexually pleasure the Japanese soldiers that occupied the peninsula. This broke all laws of consent and usually came with group sex on women, sometimes girls, beatings, and other abuses. The practice is so widely seen as disgusting by both cultures that simply mentioning the term pleasure women is seen as inappropriate. Thousands of Korean men were exiled to Japan, forced, and while this was happening, even more men were exiled from Korea to work in factories in order to support the war effort. The work conditions here were also very horrible, and many Koreans died in the workplace. However, once the U.S. dropped two rising suns on Japan, the war ended with the Japanese surrender. Japan's control of Korea was lost, and a new era of influence would be brought into the peninsula. This was the occupation era. The United States occupied the southern part of Korea, and the USSR occupied the north. This was done with the hope of developing Korea and then helping it become an independent country. However, neither side was able to agree on how this was supposed to look in practice, and the divisions of the Cold War also became very clear, and there was no trust between either side. In 1948, Syngman Rhee became president of South Korea through a democratic election. The nation was then known as the Republic of Korea. The North Korean space chose a communist-leaning system and the government that allowed the Kim dynasty to begin. And North Korea took the name the Democratic Republic of Korea. Both North and South Korea, which were now separate entities, claimed the other half as part of their sovereign territory. As time went on, things started to shift. By the end of 1949, both Soviet and U.S. soldiers had left the Korean Peninsula. In 1950, North Korea's leader, Kim Il-sung, decided that it was time to make a move on South Korea. He invaded across the border, and this began the Korean War. It was fought until 1953. The Korean War became one of the famous proxy wars between the U.S. and the USSR. The U.S. led a U.N. coalition against the forces of North Korea, and they almost ended the war. The reason they did this was because the invasion initially started by North Korea was very successful. They pushed all the way past Seoul and almost conquered all of South Korea, but the U.N. coalition resisted this. However, as the coalition, led by the U.S., pushed all the way to the China-North Korea border, China actually sent almost a million soldiers to go fight against the U.N. coalition, and this changed the tide of the war. The Chinese troops helped the North push back the South Korean front, and after 3 years of brutal fighting, the war came to an end. 80,000 soldiers died, and around 1.5 million civilians did as well. The fighting stopped, but also nothing had changed. The line of the 30th parallel that divided the two went from a very straight line to one that just adjusted for geography with a demilitarized zone. The Philippines supported South Korea in the war, and this highlighted the previously established good connection between the two. A major issue with the end of the Korean War is that it never actually ended. On paper, North and South Korea are both still at war because there was only an armistice signed, not an actual peace treaty. The demilitarized zone that I talked about couldn't be any less of a demilitarized zone. It is actually one of the most consistently patrolled and defended areas in the world, with nearly a million soldiers on it at any point. The war itself left behind truly horrendous atrocities and a lot of tension under North and South Korea. Numbers vary, but at least 100,000 Koreans were killed in different massacres across the war that weren't a part of soldier deaths. And this leads to a lot of need for change in South Korea, and that starts to come. Domestically, the April Revolution saw South Koreans push the president out of power in 1960. In 1961, Park Chung-hee led a military coup to take power in South Korea. Park Chung-hee quickly rose to become a dictator and established a cult of personality around his leadership of South Korea. Despite a lot of oppression throughout his regime, South Korea's economy did rapidly improve under Park Yi, and this is known as the Miracle on the Han River. The miracle was started by He, who created chaebols, literally means che, rich, and bols means family or clans, so rich families, and that's exactly what they were. Huge businesses were set up and given huge subsidies, tax breaks, and loans. They were also gifted with heavy tariffs placed on their competition. This was done so that the maximum production could be achieved and Korean companies could compete abroad. From this period, global companies were born in South Korea, such as LG TV, Samsung, and Hyundai. The use of chaebols had harsh downsides which can be felt even to this day. The business families that were chosen at the start of the economic shift now have a huge market share. The original chaebols are still the most important companies in South Korea today. Samsung, LG, and Hyundai dominate the market. There is even a company called Lotte, which started as a small business and now has its hands on every single industry in South Korea. On top of these giant businesses that dominate the market, they also dominate the economy. But despite the fact that they do this, they make a very little employment opportunity for the country, employing only 10% of the population despite controlling 80% of it. There have been many reports of labor laws being abused by these giant conglomerates as well. In 1979, Park Chung-hee, who had dominated politics for nearly 20 years, was assassinated. The coup of December 12th saw Chun Doo-hwan take power in the nation. Doo-hwan was authoritarian and extremely repressive politically, so he faced great resistance. In 1987, a whistleblower revealed that the police of South Korea beat college student Park Chung-chul to death. Once the public learned of this, the June democratic struggle began. It was an enormous protest that shook the capital of the nation and found support across all of South Korea. South Koreans demanded democracy and representation in their government. The June 29th declarations were the official reveal of all the concessions made by the South Korean government. This made South Korea a constitutional democracy. This decision helped the outlook on the international level, which would have many benefits in the future. In 1988, Seoul was selected to host the 24th Summer Olympic Games. This brought a lot of international attention, financial investment from foreign countries, and a bunch of different things that helped Korea grow. But nonetheless, a few years later, there would be the Asian financial crisis. Prior to the crisis, there was a rapid expansion of credit in many Asian countries. It was fueled by foreign capital inflows and easy access to cheap credit. This led to excessive lending and borrowing, as well as the accumulation of high levels of corporate and government debt. Several Asian countries, including Thailand, Indonesia, and South Korea, maintained fixed exchange rates by pegging their currencies to the U.S. dollar. This made their economies vulnerable to speculative attacks and capital flight when investor confidence waned. The crisis started in Thailand in mid-1997 when the Thai baht came under speculative attack and was forced to devalue. The crisis then rapidly spread to other countries in the region. Investors began to lose confidence in the stability of Asian currencies and financial markets, and this drove the value of currency down. The Asian financial crisis of 1997 had a huge impact on South Korea specifically, as it caused widespread economic turmoil and social upheaval. The crisis led to a sharp depreciation of the South Korean won, and this made imports more expensive and increased the cost of serving foreign countries in order to pay foreign debt. There was also the exacerbation of financial difficulties for Korean businesses because now everything was so expensive that their weak currency couldn't handle it. Many Korean companies faced high levels of bankruptcy and financial distress due to the foreign debt. The economic downturn triggered widespread social unrest and protests in South Korea. Many Koreans were angered by the perceived mismanagement of the company by the government and the Chaebols. In order to stabilize its economy, South Korea was forced to seek assistance from the International Monetary Fund, or IMF. The IMF provided a bailout package totaling $48.5 million, the largest it had given in history at that time. In exchange for financial support, South Korea had to implement austerity measures, financial reforms, and structural adjustments. South Korea also implemented a series of structural reforms to strengthen its economy and financial system. These reforms included restructuring the banking sector, improving corporate governance, and increasing transparency and accountability. Over time, South Korea demonstrated resilience and managed to rebound from the crisis. The economy gradually recovered, supported by export-led growth, technological innovation, and a dynamic private sector. South Korea emerged from the crisis with a more robust and diversified economy. The Hallyu, or Korean Wave, came as the economy fixed. As the 2000s rolled in, South Korean culture rolled out. This period is known as the Korean Wave, or the Hallyu. One of the most prominent elements of the Korean Wave is K-pop, which features South Korean pop music, which is characterized by catchy tunes, synchronized choreography, and visually appealing performances. Major groups in the K-pop genre are BTS, Blackpink, EXO, and TWICE. They have gained massive international followings and have led to sold-out concerts and dedicated fan bases worldwide. Korean television dramas, known as K-dramas, have also played a significant role in spreading the Hallyu phenomenon. These dramas often feature compelling storylines, romantic themes, and high production values, which attract viewers from diverse backgrounds. Popular K-dramas include Descendants of the Sun, Boys Over Flowers, and Crash Landing on You. They have millions of fans globally and are viewed heavily every single day. South Korean cinema has also gained recognition for its creativity, storytelling, and artistic quality. Korean films ranging from gripping thrillers to heartwarming dramas have achieved critical acclaim internationally. Directors like Bong Joon-ho made Parasite, Park Chan-wook made Oldboy, and Lee Chang-dong made Burning. They have received awards and accolades in prestigious film festivals around the world. South Korea has become a trendsetter in the beauty and fashion industries, with its innovative skincare products, makeup trends, and stylish clothing which have garnered attention worldwide. Korean beauty brands like Innisfree, Laneige, and Etude have gained popularity for their high-quality products and unique formulations. Korean cuisine, characterized by its bold flavors, diverse ingredients, and emphasis on fermentation, has gained popularity worldwide. Some of the most famous Korean dishes are kimchi, bulgogi, bibimbap, and Korean barbecue, which have become increasingly popular in the West. This has led to a rise in culinary tourism to South Korea and the spread of Korean restaurants and food globally. Another major cultural export has been Korean mixed martial arts. Some of the most famous fighters are stun gun Dong Hyun Kim, the Korean Superboy Do Ho Choi, and Seo-hee Hamdeulae Silva Ham. And some of them are greats in this current era. These fighters are all some of the greats of Korean fighting in this current era. But there may be none more well-known or influential than Chang Sung-jung, or the Korean Zombie. Fighting out of the 145-pound featherweight division, he earned his moniker for his strong chin and unique ability to take damage and keep marching forward, much like a zombie. He competed in my favorite fight of all time against Yair Rodriguez, which was a 5-round war that ended with a flash knockout in the literal last second of the match. His retirement came on August 26, 2023, and was met with both sadness and admiration. And now back to politics. The Panmunjom Declaration was signed between the leaders of North and South Korea in 2018. The treaty stated that both parties would work together in a great attempt to end the Korean conflict, which never officially ended back in the 50s. However, South Korea's location next to dictatorial North Korea and other huge powers leave it in a tough position. South Korea depends on relations with its neighbors and the U.S. to get access to trade routes and sometimes necessities like food. South Korea lacks great natural resources, so it needs to import continuously flowing resources in order to maintain the population. If relations were to falter and imports slowed, it could have a detrimental effect on the health of people in South Korea. And this is entirely possible because of the high tensions in the Middle East that slow trade with the West, and because of tensions in the Far East between China, Russia, Japan, and other countries. However, the strong relationship with the Philippines remains in the face of international change. The two share a specific defense agreement, expats in education, and a close relationship. The Philippines invests in South Korea heavily and assists with many sectors of the government. South Korea seems to have a somewhat rare but permanent friend in the Philippines. The economic inequality that has been spread across South Korea has shifted people's views on their future in the country. Over the last few decades, South Korea has gained a very sad title, the country with the lowest birth rate in the world. As of right now, it is about 0.8 kids per every woman, while the global average is 2.3 kids per woman. South Koreans are focused very hard on their work and making money because of the heightened cost of living due to economic struggle. And it's not to say that the economy of South Korea is inherently weak or bad, but there's a present issue. The fact that the cost of living is going up so much is due to the fact that the chaebols dominate everything and they pretty much set prices for whatever they want since their hands are in every sector of the government and the economy, as well as the fact that Korea's dependence on relations with its local partners make it a very dependent country, which it doesn't want to be. If things were to go south with China or Japan, it would be hard for any exports to happen at all from Korea. And if things went south in the Middle East or with the U.S., Korea would not have access to a lot of Western goods and may not get them at all. So it's a concern for South Korea, and because of this, people are less optimistic. They're much more focused on making their money and doing what they can to get by rather than starting a family in a country that they don't have a lot of confidence in. And it's all economic. It's all because of foreign relations and old things coming back up. But South Korea is nonetheless in a decent place. But I do want to still acknowledge the fact that South Korea will have one of the oldest populations in the world within a few decades. And all that being said brings us to the present, where currently South Korea is ranked as a very highly developed nation on the HGI. It has one of the largest economies in the world and has become one of the most visited places in Asia. The internal issues in South Korea, such as struggle with class mobility, regional dependency, conglomerate domination, and a declining population, make it very hard to be confident in the future happiness of South Koreans. Nonetheless, South Korea possesses all the skills, history, relations, experience, and more to lock itself into a brighter future. And that brings us to the end, where I always like to do a kind of takeaway or mindset from the history. And with South Korea, that's going to be embrace the gifts that you have and share them. This one's pretty on the nose with South Korea. I had a very different message with North Korea, which you should go back and listen to when I did that episode. It's very apparent, at least to me, that there's kind of only one thing to look for here. Look at what South Korea does for the world. The music, the food, the movies, the dance, and everything else about the culture itself is now a global export. And South Korea only has itself in that position because it believed in itself and it put itself on that global stage. It put K-pop groups out. It put out a lot of Korean food, Korean restaurants open across the world, all sorts of things like that were the risks South Korea took in order to get to a place of having global influence with a huge and healthy economy. And with that, I say you need to do that for yourself. We all have some kind of gift, be it music, skill, strength in sports, great emotional intelligence, great ability to speak, great at typing, great at accounting, any of those things. We all have a gift that can be used for the benefit of yourself and other people. And South Korea did that. South Korea knew it had all this great cultural food, had this great music, this great culture focused on producing great beauty products and all sorts of things like that. There's so many things to say about the South Korean culture, I can't even list them all. But to shift that back to you is you have something. And it's not just one, more than likely. It's a bunch of things you have to contribute. But even if it is just one thing, get great at that thing and then put it out for the world. I'm sitting here as someone who loves history, and I think I'm good enough to make a podcast about it. So now I'm here, and I'm going to try and make a whole life out of it. And you should do the same with whatever that is for you. Be that sports, be that you're great at typing, be that you're great at accounting or engineering or science or biology, whatever it is for you, just put out your gift, because you were given that by the life you lived, and if you believe it, you were given it by a creator. Whatever it was, you have gifts, and you have unique things about you that can't be found in anyone else. So take them with your personality and put them out into the world, because then you could be like South Korea and have that kind of influence that is just positive because of what you're putting out. And with that, that's all for me. South Korea is such a unique country. I've loved studying the history of North Korea when I did it. And even though they take a very different split in the 50s, both histories in this country, in this peninsula, I should say, are very cool. And South Korea itself was very, very unique. So I'm very glad I got to cover this, and I'm very glad you guys listened too. So with that being said, though, that is all I have to say. I'm going to sign off. So I'm very, very glad you guys were here. I'm very glad you got something out of this. I hope you did at least. And for whatever reason you're listening, I'm glad it keeps bringing you back. With that being said, thank you guys so much once again for listening. And my name is Reese Karlinski. This is Young History. And that cool country right there was South Korea. You guys have a good one.